We're back.
We're back.
Greg and Paul show. I'm Gregory.
And I'm Paul.
And we break down the latest in SaaS startups, AI, memes, whatever people are arguing with us on X. That is the premise of the show. So today, got a fantastic schedule. We're going to dive in first and give you an update on the SpaceX IPO.
That's a big one.
Cursor acquisition. Yeah, there's plenty of stuff to talk about regarding SpaceX. Then we'll jump into Silicon Valley's discovery of taste. I know you've got some opinions on this, right?
Lots
of opinions on taste. Okay. We'll talk about the very cool new Snapchat glasses. People on X are pretty excited about roasting Evan when it comes to the design of those. We've got something on, what is this? Right. Satya from Microsoft wrote an essay about AI and frontier ecosystems. And I spent
a
lot of time.
Strong opinion. Yeah.
I spent a lot of time thinking about this last night. Yeah. I read the whole thing. I mean, I'm a huge fan. I think he's a brilliant guy. I really like him a lot. And I wanted to like really make sure I was prepared for our discussion today. So I dove deep in, got a lot of opinions on that one. We'll come back to that. You've got something from Tokenomics. We'll talk about SoftBank trying to save their investment in OpenAI. We've got the Midjourney spa opening up.
That's right. That's a pivot. It's like once you kind of see what they're doing, it's not a huge pivot, but it's awesome.
It's cool. I hope we'll talk about it. And then what is this? Untrainable. What is that? One more topic.
I actually kind of kicked it off of the schedule, but if we have time,
okay,
we'll talk about
it. We'll come back to
basically
it.
Basically, it's...
Yep. All right. So the news this week, or I guess it was this week, right? Regarding SpaceX completing the acquisition deal with Cursor. I read a bunch of stuff about this. I watched some interviews that were quite interesting. There was an interview with Sean McGuire, partner at Sequoia Capital on Bloomberg, just discussing the SpaceX IPO, and he mentioned or spoke at length about the Cursor acquisition and said some really interesting things that, like, you know, it was almost like a trial period to some degree. And he was saying that, like, they passed, that they demonstrated that they could work with the SpaceX team, they could work with Elon, that they all got along and were happy with, like, how things just kind of came together in terms of, like, team, workflow, culture, that type of thing, which was super interesting. It's a monster deal, of course. And what I heard was that the acquisition of Cursor and then all of the new AI, what do we call them, data compute deals, you know, that doubles SpaceX's revenue already from what was in the S-1. It's quite impressive. Stock's down, of course. I'm not surprised by that. I don't think it'll trade below the IPO price. In fact, I'm looking at the Poly market. It looks like it's going to end the month, or people are betting it's going to end the month anywhere from like 1.5 to 2.5 trillion. What do you think about all this SpaceX news, the acquisition, stock price? Can't hear you.
I can't tell if it's the real deal or not.
If what's the real deal?
If like this buying Cursor is a real deal, I know. Or not. So, like, I know that they're
a real deal. You mean like that, meaning like the deal won't go through?
I really don't know. It could be completely up in air. We think that the administration, Trump's administration, is kind of merger happy.
I see. It's got to pass regulatory scrutiny.
Of course. Like, so it's kind of like 3 months ago, people were writing Cursor off as like they're just just a wrapper around GPT and stuff. And now it's worth like $60 billion on paper. I'm a little bit very, very skeptical.
I like the skepticism. I mean, dude, the Trump administration is going to block Elon from buying Cursor. That just seems preposterous when you put it.
They just got into a room with Sam Altman with all the AI leaders at the G7. Did you see that?
Yeah. So did they stop anyone from doing anything? No.
No. But like, I mean, they'll have conversations, right? Like this is if this deals go through, Cursor is training their Composer 2 model, and basically they will have Elon's infrastructure behind it. They basically become the second biggest model company after Google.
Correct.
No other company has infrastructure.
So, regarding regulatory scrutiny, because I got in a couple of Twitter fights with people over this one. Yeah, look, the Trump administration is not going to block any of the things that Elon wants to do from like a regulatory perspective.
So the
like,
deal will go
that
through.
One just seems like, That's my perspective. I find it highly unlikely. Like it just seems like The Biden administration, very different story, right? They were blocking basically everything.
Every deal.
So every deal, not just Elon, but every deal. I can't imagine that the Trump administration is going to block this. And I think that there are clear competitors in the market. It's not like they're forming a monopoly. As ridiculous as the Figma Canva acquisition was, it does actually consolidate the market in a way that this doesn't. So I think the regulatory piece, the only thing I was saying, regulatory piece is this, because I actually think it makes the likelihood of the Tesla SpaceX merger high as well, because that deal has to happen in a friendly regulatory regime. So I think Elon has a limited amount of time to make that happen. I think you pointed out that they got to spike the stock to get the valuation up in order to acquire Tesla. All right, that's my statement.
Yeah. Okay. Basically, there's a massive financial engineering thing going on with SpaceX stock, which is impressive. They basically locked up all of their investors to basically flow $60 billion to first buy Cursor and then maybe floating another $500 billion to buy Tesla.
But it'll get them revenue, right? So the flip side of all of this is that so if you do a price to sales calculation for SpaceX, it's 95, it's really high. So if they make all these acquisitions, the revenue metrics go way up, and then they get to let's say they combine, and Tesla's just for the sake of argument, 1.1 trillion, SpaceX, let's say it's 1.1 trillion or 2 trillion, you get 3.5, 4 trillion. And that gives Elon, he's half the way there to the 7.5 trillion. So I think it's a done deal in my mind. I even would go as far to say,
I see.
Elon has planned all this out. I think this is exactly what's going to happen. But this is very different than will it work? Will Cursor be successful, right? They have competition, Codex and Claude Code. So that's the part that I don't know.
Yeah. This comes into dropping token price, right? So if they successfully launch Composer, which is basically an open source model distilled, it could work. It could work. They could drop token price meaningfully below competitors.
Yeah. I think it's cool. I think it shows that the vision on the XAI side, that they're going to have a play in all of these spaces and there's going to be people that use it. I believe Anduril, a lot of defense companies are using Grok and stuff. So there's going to be a market for it.
Prediction on Tesla versus SpaceX will emerge by the end of the year. Oh, she says 45% chance
of being acquired by the end of the year. The merger will happen?
Yeah, or merger. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to happen. I don't know. The timing is really hard to figure out. I don't know what incentives or what would play into the timing. Like I said, I they have to do it under Trump. I think they have to do it when the SpaceX stock is at its strongest, which I think is the next year. I think I would bet it happens this year, I guess. So there, that Polymarket is 45%. I think it's much higher. I think the likelihood that it happens this year is pretty strong. Doesn't have to, but yeah, I'm going to go with that. I'm thinking the other side of it. What is the other side of that bet? So I'm in the 45% then.
45%? I'm just funding, I guess. But how is he going to fund this? Is he going to flow 25% of SpaceX to fund it?
Yeah, he'll have I don't know. They just print stock, dude.
Yeah. So he dilutes all of his shareholder by, 25%? $1 billion, let's say. $1.5 trillion.
That's just a number.
It's just a number to float $1 trillion worth of stocks.
Oh my God.
We'll see.
What else do we need to say about SpaceX? Anything? I think we've talked plenty about.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. We got comments on a lot of SpaceX videos. There's some funny ones saying are we short sellers? And I said, Paul's short, but I'm long.
I'm short. I'm not going to bet against Elon. At least not, not in the long term.
They'd have to be a crazy person to short. No matter how much you want to, and no matter how much you think it's overvalued, I think you have to be crazy too.
I do not bet against that man in the long run.
Yeah, I think that's a crazy place to be. I think on the share price, there were a few comments, and I think ultimately,
I think it'll stable out at $200. It's dropped to 175 today, but it was stable out.
Look, I think the fact that the stock is trading within a relatively small range of the IPO price to under 200 or 250.
Exactly.
It's frustrating for some people because I think it proves there's no bubble. They actually got the demand correct. I heard some people saying when it spiked up, they mispriced it. They should have sold more. Like, well, it's kind of, it came down today. I think it all went flawlessly. I think it proves, like, at this point, there's no bubble. So I remember the dot-com bubble, and I remember when, like, things go public, and they were just, like, garbage stocks, and they would just, like, skyrocket in a single day. And yep. In my opinion, that's a pretty good yep. sign that you're in just a bubble where people are just completely gambling.
Piling on. Yeah, yeah.
Just yeah, and that didn't happen. So I think, like, we're still in this interesting space where the AI build out and digital transformation from AI is real. And, like, the prices are relatively reasonable given expectations for
yep.
change.
Yeah. More interested to see, like, when the institutions sell, or the with the thousands of millionaires, newly minted millionaires.
There's going to be some selling of institutions, but, like, a lot of people will be able to get loans against it. So they don't need to sell.
They have to pay taxes on it if they, regardless, right? Like,
if they sell.
I think there's some, there's probably some triggers that they have to pay tax on.
I'm not an accountant, but I don't know how, it depends on how it's set up. But a lot of people are able to get loans against it. So some of the early investors who, like, have billions now, they're able to just use that as collateral and, like, set up a venture fund. I think it's going to be really bullish for technology industry. I think it's bullish for startups. I think it's bullish for Austin and a Bay Area tech ecosystem. I think there's a lot of winners in those places. And I think a lot of that money is going to come. It's going to come back.
Full circle back investment. I hope so. Okay. Shall we move on to Taste Lab?
Okay. Silicon Valley finding Taste. How do you want to kick this one off? You want to start with the launch of an app called Taste, or is that the place to
begin? Yeah, yeah. I mean, just, like, quickly summarize. So this company called Taste Labs announced that they raised $18.5 million to give AI taste, or train a foundational model that has taste, I suppose. Long story short, they're kind of like a service company. They're a foundational AI company. Not exactly sure what their product is, but essentially they are training AI to recognize good design. That's their core product right now. And then the post went super viral, millions of views. People are destroying them in the comments. Things like, how is it possible for you to train an AI in taste? We're just taking the humanity out of everything that we do. Taste is not something that AI can replace. Yeah, I mean, totally. What do you think? Opinions?
I don't know. I mean, like, look, I want to be nice about it, because, like, at the highest level, I think startups are cool. I think innovation is cool. I think doing new things is cool. I think trying crazy things is cool. Like, at a high level, I'm very supportive of all this stuff. And I know it's hard to go out there and take a controversial stance on something like this and just put yourself out there, right? So I want to start with that. On the other hand, I think I thought some of the criticism is warranted. I think that, like, if you hang your hat on this, you should expect a lot of feedback and criticism. And like, I think part of it is, like, it's a test. Like, okay, if you're telling me, like, this is, like, what you stand for, like, how do you back it up? How do you prove it? How do you convince people that, yeah, like, right. Yeah, I am the expert. I am the person that is going to be able to do this. Something that's very hard, because it's subjective, it's not easy to quantify. So I think they dug their own hole, because I don't think they've done a great job so far of proving that they are the ultimate arbiters of taste.
Yeah. I mean, like, the entire, so if you read into their manifesto or, like, the product line, basically they just put together a group of curated experts or tastemakers, and then they're training AI based on their judgment, right? So they, like, throw a design at this panel, the panel will debate on it, and it'll tell you what they think about this taste or this design.
I thought that, like,
it's like,
so okay, so we talked at length about this yesterday, and I think I formulated like a very concise criticism of the approach that they're taking.
Yeah.
I don't think they mapped out the universe of potential taste signals and have a taxonomy that makes any sense to anybody who's an expert in a space. So if I was to go to, like, all my, like, look, dude, I mean, like, my design buddies, like, I was a designer, I went to an art high school, right? Trained as a graphic designer with, like, X-Acto knives and, like, cut up film and all this stuff in the old days, right? And so if you talk to, like, anyone in that world, and you were going to say, like, we've got this tool and it's going to figure it all out for you. Like, okay, like people might take that seriously. There's some people that would just totally laugh and were not on board. That's okay. So, okay. So it's not their audience. But you would have to have like a really well thought out like taxonomy of like how you're going to provide the right taste given the context. So a really good example for me would be like in the design world. There's a lot of people who like thought supermarket tabloid design was horrible. Okay. You know, like the giant headlines and aliens and celebrities and all of that, right? But a very well-respected graphic designer wrote a fantastic piece about supermarket tabloid design. And he explained it within the context of what they're doing, like why it works, why it's successful, why they're talented, how it's hard. And I think he did a really good job at convincing a lot of people who perhaps don't necessarily respect that kind of work, that within the context and the framework of what they were doing, that they were actually experts in their space. So I think for me, that's a really good example where like, so far what I've seen with this like taste app, it just kind of paints everything with a single brush. And I think that's why I use that example was that when you have a, if you were to have like some kind of like map of the market or some way to define the landscape and said like, here's the like 657 different design taste signals that we have identified. And within each of those, here are the different methodologies that we believe determine if it is good or not, right? I actually believe you could do this, but it would just have to be like done in such a way that it took the context into consideration for a lot of like specific use cases and examples. And I would go as far to say like, there are creative people out there who I think are actually quite good at this. Usually people pick a few lanes and they're good at that. There actually are people that are fantastic at like understanding a lot of different genres, understanding a lot of different approaches. Rick Rubin would be an example. Like I was listening to that playlist the other day. There's like rock and metal and country and rap. Like the guy's all over the place and they're all bangers, right? So there are people out there that can do this, right? So at the, so to summarize, they just didn't do a good job of like convincing me that they have like this brain, that they have this all mapped out and they're going to weight everything and they're going to like figure it all out, right? Maybe that's what they're doing, but they haven't communicated that effectively. I can't hear you, dude.
How do you think someone can convince you that they have good taste? Is it something that you can convince people of?
Well, that's a different question, right? Like this all assumes that like, there's going to be people who just like resist this and just don't believe it, don't accept it.
Of course.
Don't
of
like course. It. That's fine. I would want them to have mapped it all out so that it's like, hey, supermarket tabloid design is this and wedding invitation design on the West Coast in Napa Valley looks like this and punk rock album 7-inch artwork in Scotland is this, right? Because I think all of those are not universal in terms of like what is good, what is bad, what is high quality, what is not high quality. How do you incorporate like irony into all of this is another question to have. Which I think they need actually a valid answer for, which I think is important. So yeah, I just haven't seen anything that like convinced me that there was like anything real there other than like, we've got a bunch of like generic modern design that looks like every other website I've seen over the last five years.
Yeah. Everybody's in black polos in all of their screenshots.
Hey, mine's blue.
Right. It's like, how does that at all say that you have good taste?
Is black polo in fashion or something? I don't know where. Anyway,
I don't think so. Looks like you work at like a golf range or something.
Great, that's what I'm aiming for. Dude, at my age, we didn't talk about this yet. I'm gonna be 50. It's my birthday this month.
Congrats!
And there's nothing that sounds more attractive than just spending all of my time on the golf course right now. That sounds like a great life. Anyway, yeah, like just I wasn't convinced. Like it seemed like it was too superficial. How's that for an answer?
Yeah, totally. I really have nothing more to say about this. It's just like, I feel like they launched this. It's not really for their customers. It feels like it was just kind of like, hey, we collected these investors. We're solving this problem. We have this mission. Nothing to back it up. Nothing to back it up.
The other thing is like, they had this, the vision was so lofty. If you were to boil it down and say, interactive environments, UX and UI is a problem that we can solve.
Mm-hmm.
Every aspect of it, the visual design, the color, everything, that I actually believe 100%. Like if they had said that, like there's a big part of my things like Figma and also goes away. Like there's no need for it at all. Every design element, everything that fits on like a website or an application or a digital screen is 100% quantifiable and solvable ultimately. If they constrained it to that, I'd be much more supportive of what they're doing and really excited about it because I believe that 100%. I have friends in the like digital design world who told me they believe this was going to happen years ago, actually. They're like, at this point, like it's all been tested so much. There's so many templates. There's not a lot of creativity left. Like the whole space has been solved. And so I do believe that, right? And, you know, and that was what ultimately I believe they're aiming for with the first version of this. And so that makes a lot of sense. That might even be like a very useful tool.
Do you think it's like, this is like West Coast trying to figure out taste because they're jealous that, you know, New York is kind of like the tastemaker? Do you think it's like a West Coast versus East Coast thing?
That's certainly a one take on all this stuff, right? It's like nerds are trying to figure out like how to be cool and they're not very good at it.
And they're like just completely, they're throwing money at the problem, right? This is a very SV Silicon Valley kind of way of solving problems. Just like create a startup to solve it.
Like, you know.
It's a very San Fran SV.
I mean, like in America, so there's cultural things too. In the United States, like we're not very good at being subtle or understated. And like, we perceive actually that as being cool, right?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And so I don't know. There's so much rolled into all of this stuff. There's a lot of nuance to it. I don't know.
Let's move on.
I'm done with this. I think we talked plenty about this.
Let's move on. Let's talk about the next one, which is...
oh my God, talk about bad taste. These Snapchat spectacles. Did you see this video and stuff?
I consumed a lot of media.
I wish I had. It's like, they're so big, dude. The thing is like, it's like giant on his head. Like, oh my God. Like he's wearing them. And the look on his face, like Evan from Snapchat. He looks like he thinks it's awesome, which is the best part, actually. I think it makes it all really funny. It's like, they look bonkers ridiculous. Like they're huge and big and they're like crushing his ears and he's wearing them in the interview. Like they're the greatest thing. He spent all this effort and $3 billion researching these things. And I mean, every take on X was just like, these things look, they just look ridiculous.
So like, the VCs are saying, okay, this guy will figure it out. He's like on like iteration 2 or 3 or something, he will figure it out. But like at that point, do you think people care?
I mean, like, I read there's some great posts from people who are like, I made an AR glass company that sold Apple and these things are a technological miracle. I'm like, that might all be true, but they still look ridiculous.
They look ridiculous.
Like no one's going to wear them. They don't look even like comfortable. Like, I just don't understand like how that is even like a thing. Like even though I tried that. I did the Apple ones, the Vision Pro.
Right, the Vision Pro.
It is a technological marvel. It's quite impressive. Like when you put them on and you utilize it, it's really cool. But like the whole apparatus and stuff, I feel like I'm in a VR lab like in Palo Alto. Like I don't want to walk around with this stuff. I can't imagine like, I'm going to take like the New York City subway up to the Bronx to see my dad with this thing on. Like, I'm not crazy. Like, it just doesn't make any sense from like a real world. But yeah, I'm going to jump on the number 6 train and get on the express uptown. Like, this is not going to happen.
Well, do you think could we like invent some utilitarian kind of thing that people will actually wear at these classes and then people just suffer the ridicule?
Dude, my take was that
because
like,
remember, eyeglasses was not cool. You know, like
they're
maybe
not
like
cool.
50 years ago, eyeglasses was, but now it's a fashion statement a little bit. You know, like people don't make fun of you for wearing glasses now. That's not a thing anymore. Maybe like 50 years ago, or like even 30 years ago, if you wore glasses in school as a kid, people would make fun of you.
I always wore glasses, and they tried to get me to wear contacts. I was like, these are really uncomfortable, and
no.
I don't like them. I was like, I just own it. Like, I'm proud. I always said this. I was like, I'm proud I have glasses.
Yeah,
I want the
because,
biggest,
like, you need glasses.
Nerdiest, like, blackest glasses possible. Like, dude, that is just who I am.
Right. But you justify it because, you know, you need glasses.
I need glasses. People would be like, dude, are those fake? I'm like, no, put them on.
So, like, you don't think, like, there's a world where people would be walking around with these glasses because they need it, they'll suffer the ridicule, and then somehow it becomes a fashionable thing to do 20 years down the road.
Okay, this is what I seriously think, is that it's just a failed experiment. I don't think AR, VR glasses are going to be an effective tool or user interface for computer-human interaction. That's what I think.
Gotcha.
I think like there's too many challenges. Like, so the Apple One works. Like, you put it on and you're really in a full VR environment. Like, it was crazy. And it's got like the Apple icons and the UI. Like, it was actually like really, really impressive and really cool to use. But it doesn't seem practical. Like, it's hard to talk to other people. Like, if you're in an office with same people, or you're home with your family, like, let's not go there. You're in an office with other people and you're trying to like communicate, like, you have to do it through digital technology. Like, it just seems to have these like hard to overcome challenges. You got to wear like a big apparatus, no matter how, like, maybe they get it to be like this, maybe, but like, they're pretty far.
Yeah.
From that. Like, so it like messes up your hair and like they're expensive. And then like, so just, it just seems like at this point, I'm like, I just don't know. Is this like even like a great way to interact with a computer? Because I think voice and these pucks or these necklaces, like, I think like I met a guy at an event in San Francisco. He didn't get back to me. He invented his own like AI device that you would carry around. It was like, listen to stuff and then you could talk to it. I think that's a much better UI. I'm much more excited about that than like wearing glasses. I mean, I wear glasses, and if they could make them like my glasses and they were like cool, I probably would use it. But I still think it's a niche thing. Like, I like the watch. I have an Apple Watch. I run with it. There's a few things to do with it, but it's not like an everyday thing.
Okay. Should we move on to talk about Satya's 5,000 words?
Oh my God. Are you ready for this? I got a lot to say.
Okay. You got lots to say on this.
All right. Do you want to kick this off?
Yeah. Okay. So Satya, CEO of Microsoft, wrote a 5,000 word essay on a frontier without an ecosystem is not scalable. To really sum it up, is he, of course, he's selling Microsoft. Of course, he's selling AI. But the core of it, he's saying that the moat for all of these companies, I think, is good judgment. He's saying that you need to, within your company, you need to systematize, curate good judgment, and it will become the replacement for human labor, let's say, for humans. I think it's really on point. It's the first time that I saw a CEO wrote something that I agree with. What's your take on all of this?
So I'm looking at this thing on X right now, 65 million views.
Yeah, it's gone super viral.
40 million likes. That's pretty good. Well, like I said earlier, I'm a huge fan. I think this guy's brilliant. I like Satya a lot. I think he's done some great stuff. I think he's been in some excellent memes. I wish those memes were more popular. The Satya as a kid at the mainframe, whatever, is fantastic.
Yeah, at the mainframe.
At the mainframe. It's so good. I read this thing. And okay, so I think there's a lot to discuss here. So he says a couple, he makes a couple of big statements about the future and about what he thinks AI means for like the economy and for jobs. So on the one hand, he's very bullish in saying that like human expertise is going to matter more than ever. That like, even if you have all these tools, you still need judgment, human judgment. It's really important to like judge the output. I think everyone at a high level agrees with that and is definitely seeing this across the board.
Yeah. Yep.
So he makes that statement and he's like, I'm very bullish about humans and human expertise. But he also says that he thinks that AI is going to hollow out certain industries and like suck all of the knowledge out of it, codify into tools and reduce the value that humans bring. And he compares it to deindustrialization and offshoring, like in the 80s and 90s, when a lot of factory jobs went overseas, right? And so at first I read this and I was like, is he contradicting himself? Like, is he saying that like on one hand, human expertise matters, and then saying on the other hand, no, human expertise don't matter, right? So I thought about it. At first I thought that that's what he's saying. And I looked at like all the replies and stuff. They're all across the board. People are saying all kinds of crazy stuff, of course.
Of course.
But I thought more about it. And then I believe the point he's trying to make is that offshoring reduced labor. So like the cognitive jobs, the intellectual jobs, the sophisticated jobs, the like design teams, the project managers, the accountants, they all retained their job, right? If you were talking about like car manufacturing or any kind of manufacturing.
Correct.
But labor is what got outsourced and for the most part offshored, right? So is the analog for like AI that a lot of the like grunt work, a lot of the like things that are relatively simple and straightforward for AI to do, those are things that go away. But is that a hollowing out of the industry or not, right? So that was my ultimately, and like he wasn't, I don't think he was super clear about this in the essay, that like that there's going to be winners and losers, like there always is with any kind of transition. And he seemed to be taking the side of the fact that the, or I couldn't rationalize this piece, and maybe that's the contradiction here, is that he wants to like be very positive and say, hey, we need to like find a way to ensure that the hollowing out doesn't happen. But how does that happen if AI is so fantastic at automating a bunch of stuff and taking away all of those like menial office jobs?
I think the only hope is that, okay, first of all, it is a little bit of like a double speak. Whatever he's saying about like a human replacement, it's going to happen. But at the same time, he's saying that like the timeline is uncertain. So it could take a really long time. You basically just need to kind of be there when your jobs go away. That's basically like, overall, I agree with him, because everything that you're using AI to, everything that you're using AI will replace, eventually replace what you do. But I think if the intent is replacement, we just need to level ourselves up and do more as an industry. And this is already happening in the software space. So to your point, I think this is just the inevitable.
But like, does it, I still can't figure out like from his statements in this article, does human expertise matter or not, right? Like, does human judgment matter or not? Like, that's the part where I got really confused, or I don't think it's very clear.
That's the double speak, right? It's, of course it matters, because it's going to train the AI.
So I actually think that everyone's wrong. I don't think a lot of jobs are going to go away. I think new jobs are going to emerge. I think people will use AI to do new things. I think it'll create an arms race where all kinds of new things emerge, because you can open the door to doing new things. So I'll give you, here's a really good example. I know someone who's working with like a GTM team to find all of the signals that indicate a customer is a good customer. And they have all this data going back a long time that they know that certain customers who don't get flagged in whatever system they have today as like a high quality lead end up closing and becoming great customers. And they have lots of data on this. So they're like, okay, can we use AI to go out there and find a lot more signals that are much more difficult for us to access, and then use all those signals to help us have a better model to determine who is a great customer? So for me, like, this is a good example of like an entirely new thing that people are doing with AI. It's not going to take away any jobs. It actually adds more jobs, because they're doing more and they're becoming more efficient. They already had automated it. In fact, like, the automation didn't work very well and was like not identifying great opportunities for them. So they're going to invest more to find more opportunities. And so what this will mean is that if successful, which I believe the early testing says will be successful, it'll encourage other people to do it. And then that will create more jobs for people. And then eventually everyone will do this. And then it's like a zero sum gain, right? You'll need to find some other way to improve your business and get an edge over competitors, which means more investment in other areas. So
yeah,
that's what I believe at a high level. Like, will clerical work and things, they're already on the way out anyway, right? Like, people used to have secretaries when I was younger. Like, no one has a secretary anymore, right? Like, or if you have a personal assistant, they're doing all kinds of stuff for you, right? They're vibe coding for you. They're not just like listening to you talk and then typing what you say.
So you think like the humans will always be in the loop for certain things, and the AI agents will just, is that true though? Like, isn't that the whole purpose of AI? It's just slowly take over.
Well, there's also nothing. There's a lot of jobs that AI doesn't touch. So I also think that like, if we want jobs, there will be jobs. I think some of this is cultural and attitudes. Like, you don't have to have a yoga instructor to do yoga. You don't need to go and get a massage. You can get instant coffee. You don't need to go to a coffee shop and have a barista pull you a gourmet coffee, right? So there's all kinds of things that can happen in the economy that ultimately just come down to like personal preference and taste. So I'm not convinced that like AI means all the jobs go away. I think that like human desire is infinite. And I think we'll always want things, and there'll be new things that we want, and they'll, we'll create new jobs. So I think it really comes down to like, what kind of world do we want to live in? What kind of like regulatory environment is there?
Right.
What kind of like how easy it is to start companies, and people who want jobs will have jobs. I think it comes down to almost desire.
Right. Maybe it's just kind of like the definition of jobs will change. It wouldn't be, you know, definitely not factory jobs. It's not going to be the white collar jobs that we were thinking about, sitting in front of a computer typing. I think it's going to be just about building human relationships. I don't think we'll eventually get to a point where you rely on agents or AI to do all sorts of
relationships. Okay, here's a really controversial take.
Yeah.
There's too much regulation. That's why there's not as many jobs as we need. And I'm someone who like, okay, this is probably the most controversial thing I'll say on the podcast today is like, this is an argument against the minimum wage. So like, why should the government control what I'm able to sell my labor for, right? And if you were able to like let people sell their labor for lower costs, you would have more jobs. And there are examples of this around the world that it's actually quite beneficial for the economy. I know this is a really controversial take. A lot of people don't like this, but all the data, including the data that and research that the Obama administration did when they instituted the higher minimum wages, indicate that a higher minimum wage will remove jobs. Basically always does.
Of course.
So this is a really easy one to understand, but there's lots of other regulations and things out there that make it difficult for people to like start companies and have jobs. So if we want jobs, just make it easier for people to start companies and have jobs.
So, right. So this goes back into like the whole entire argument of like labor replacement ever since like the 70s, 60s even.
The regulations are what encourage labor replacement, like in fast food, right? McDonald's is trying to get rid of everybody. They're going to have all computers everywhere because like it's too difficult to manage the people.
Regulation, in theory, protects the people.
I would say this. Regulation is sold to the voters as protecting the voters. That's how they get it passed.
Protecting the voting class. Correct.
As protecting the voters. I don't think anyone... Actually, I know that they have research when they pass these laws that say that they're even wrong. So in my opinion, it's done to get the law passed. It's not that they even believe that that's what it does.
Of course. It's wrong in retrospect because all of the economists that... putting this policy.
Their own research indicates that it's not going to do what they say it does. Their own research.
Yes, because they didn't factor in human nature, right? The whole entire premises, and this involves AI as well, is if AI takes over all of the boring stuff, people will just educate themselves to do the more interesting stuff.
Do other stuff.
Yeah. That was the whole entire thesis with like offshoring, moving all of the manufacturing overseas as well, right? Like we offshore all the factory low
but level, it's so like I know job. It's not perfect. I know there's a lot of other things. This is a complicated topic. It did happen though. We have low unemployment, people have jobs, right? So like they're not all factory jobs, and I would argue like factory jobs are not great jobs. They could be really
all the factory jobs. Correct. So we got really rid of manufacturing. We got rid of manufacturing and replaced it instead of with like research, R&D, like
yoga instruction, retail.
We replaced it with service.
Services, yes.
But like again, service is like there's no intellectual kind of. It's like, you know, service is still like a low cost.
Yeah, but like a factory job is a shitty job too, dude. They're not great jobs. It's like a fallacy that somehow like working a mine is a great job. I'm like, dude, it's not.
It's not. I'm not arguing with that, right? Like I'm just saying the expectation of moving these offshores is instead of becoming a service economy, we become like a research economy where we export knowledge.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So I guess like what matters here is what does AI ultimately mean for jobs? Right. And so I think like what we know is
well, the hope is that instead of me sitting here typing code, doing like meaningless, time sucking, white labor, white collar jobs, like bookkeeping, for example, right? Like it will make us level up, get more educated and do more fun things.
That I agree with. I mean, like
is that most people won't do this. They will just like fall back to something that's intellectually unstimulating, and they just, you know, bet on Kaushi instead.
I mean, I guess at the highest level, I guess I look at things more like it's inevitable AI happens, it's inevitable the job transformation happens. So like it's not a matter of like do we want this or not? Like it's just gonna happen. And so what are the implications of it? I think that like we've constantly proved that new jobs emerge, and so I believe that really deeply, and I think it's happening now. So don't believe that all the jobs go away, and it never has. Because I think it's like it's desire. Like, do we want jobs, and do we want them to be? That's why I would advocate for, like, you know, making it like reducing some of the regulatory burden to make it easier to open up coffee shops. That seems like a pretty reasonable thing, actually. Like, I'm very well aware that, like, minimum wage is a controversial thing. There's a lot of people who are supportive of it. That's fine. Okay. I'm not saying it has to go away, but like, you could make it easier to be a barista. There's a lot of people that want to do that. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, right? Like, that's cool. Like, that's what people want to do. So, like, and people want to buy that.
Yeah, the danger of that is, like, if you make that into the case, then the only people that will win are the corporations, right? Like, it becomes cheaper to hire baristas, the margin goes up.
Well, I mean, haven't the corporations already won? Like, right?
Possibly.
Like, I mean, that's the other thing with, like, Satya here is, like, who is this article for? Like, what is he ultimately trying to say?
Right.
Like,
what's the meaning behind the double speak?
There's a lot of arguments that, like, his AI lab is behind, and he's just saying this because, like, they're not winning, which is valid. Because ultimately, he's trying to make a case for, like, you need your own kind of AI initiative internally to protect all of your data. And all of that, I actually think, is true. And that if there's only a few places to get the AI from, that's not a healthy environment. I think that's more actually what his point was that trying to, like, manage that. And that's a really complicated problem.
I read this. I think what I took away is just, you know, this is coming. Don't be asleep at the wheel. It's going to happen over the next decade, let's say. And you have more than enough time to be aware of what's happening. I think that's the real danger.
He didn't mention it, but, like, you know, sovereign AI, right? Like, do certain countries need to have their own? And, like, I think all those are really valid questions. Like, if there's only a few frontier labs out there that have these incredible models and stuff.
There's only a handful.
I don't know. We didn't talk anything about, like, the new Mythos and, like, what happened with the Trump administration and mm-hmm. how they had to, like, roll the whole thing back. And, like, there's some people I know personally who are, like, security people who are like, this thing is dangerous. They're, like, really, really concerned about Mythos and stuff. So there's a lot at play here. I don't know. I don't know the answer ultimately, right? Like, but it looks like these things are just going to become protected. Like, it's going to be, I'm not sure what the word is, but they're going to be, they're of interest of national security, and they're going to be regulated. That would be the right term.
I agree. Okay, let's move on. We got, let's move on.
Do we do
on
that one to death?
One.
Okay.
Which actually, it kind of, like, also ties into this, right?
Okay.
All of this could be completely meaningless discussion if the tokenomics doesn't work. So tokenomics used to be a term for crypto, but the AI sphere took that over. It basically means, like, how much do tokens cost? Citadel came out with a published paper that says token cost relatively has been going down, but it's not going down fast enough because a lot of people are still burning tokens. So, like, this is the Jevons paradox where token cost goes down, more access, people piling in. AI companies tell people to token max, and the cost of AI goes up massively. This is all goes hand in hand with companies killing the subsidies where passes can get you more tokens than the amount of money that you're paying. And that's coming to an end where enterprises are now being forced to pay for the actual token cost. So in some cases where somebody was paying like $100K a month, and now they're paying $1 million a month, which is like a 10x increase in the last 6 months. So basically, this is like a long story short of it. If token cost doesn't come down, none of this matters. Like, literally nothing matters.
I mean, absolutely. The Satya article assumes that, like, tokens are free or really cheap.
Yeah, he's assuming that token will continuously fall.
And that is not
the reality.
It's not clear that that's what's going to happen. It could, but it's not clear.
Yeah. So as soon as people start to think about how much their tokens cost, and they start thinking about bills, which a lot of Fortune, like 100 companies are starting to think about because CFOs are getting involved. There's going to be a lot of, like, scrutiny to who's using models, who's using AI, which department gets allocation. That's going to be a whole entire.
Yeah. I mean, let's say this. I would put a number, I said 60% chance that AI costs don't come down fast enough. to create anything like any of these job apocalypse scenarios, even in like the white collar world, that it just ultimately isn't that cheap. And that's what actually holds it back. Like, yeah, that's what I think is actually.
It's going to get, I think like people in the AI sphere is grossly underestimating how long this is going to take. Right? Like phone, people were still buying phone cards and phone minutes, what, like 20 years ago, 15 years ago? It took them like 15 years to basically get
took a
into
long
to
time.
Replace. Took us the last decades.
Dude, the last telegram was sent like 15 years ago or something. Like right. There still were telegraph operators.
Telegraph fax is still a thing in certain corners of the world.
Dude, people still use faxes. Okay, let's do this OpenAI thing.
Yeah, that's pretty. Do you want to take this one or?
Yeah. So there's like a news announcement. SoftBank, one of the backers of Sam Altman and OpenAI, has reportedly been trying to borrow against its $6 billion, 13% stake in OpenAI. So it's not clear if like they don't think it's worth what it was worth anymore, but it sounds like they have some kind of cash crunch going on over there. They want a margin loan. I mean, I deeply admire Masa's just tenacity and his just sheer cojones to like make these just massive bets. But OpenAI is like not the darling anymore. I read that like market share for them in AI search is now below 50%, I think. So it looks tough for OpenAI at the moment.
Yeah. I agree. Also, like the fact that, you know, they're trying to borrow against OpenAI, the same, we literally just said, you know, people are going to borrow against SpaceX stocks and they couldn't, SoftBank couldn't do it. This is like tight.
Sounds like they can't get the valuation, right? So yeah, it's interesting.
Half a they're what, like $800 billion? So like they're nowhere near that valuation, which is a little bit scary because their IPO is coming up.
Yeah. At the moment, it doesn't look good, right? It looks like they go IPO and it might struggle.
It's just my struggle. That is scary.
Okay. That would be my bet. Not an opener. I did buy a bunch of SpaceX stock. I made some money. I lost some money. It was fun. It was great.
Are you gonna keep buying until?
You know, at the moment, I'm trying to figure out like where this price settles. I haven't made up a decision. Like I got some of the IPO shares right. So if it goes below the IPO price, I'll definitely buy some. I don't expect that to happen in the short term. So we'll see. I mean, I think it's richly valued, so I'm trying not to like buy at the top of the market. I do expect there to be some weakness, and that's when I'll pick up some more shares. But I have a big chunk of money set aside that I do want to put into SpaceX, and I want to be for a long time. Yeah, for maybe for life.
Okay, we're gonna skip the untrainable and just jump into Midjourney. I think
this is so
move.
Cool.
So Midjourney yesterday announced.
Wait, tell people who Midjourney is, because that part's really important.
Midjourney is one of the AI companies, foundational AI companies with their own models that are focused on generating text to image. And they also do a little bit of image to image.
And they are bootstrapped.
And they're bootstrapped. Correct.
Yeah.
Never raised money.
Crazy.
Just purely, purely based on giving people a good product.
Did these guys make this model in their mom's basement or something? Like, how did they do this? Do you have
for
any
the longest
story?
Time, yeah.
Are they for a lab from a university story. Or something? I don't know the Midjourney like backstory at all.
Their founder is like cracked. That's all I know.
Okay.
This guy.
I like it.
David Holes. He's pretty active on X as well. Anyways, so they just announced coming out saying that they are opening up a spa with full body ultrasound. What a pivot. Holy
Wild.
Crap.
I think it's so cool. I think like they invented something cool. They like just did it themselves. They bootstrapped. They made a bunch of money. And then they're just going to pivot into something completely different. It's crazy. I think it's really cool. I think all this medical technology is going to emerge in the next 10, 15 years is going to be
100%. It's so cool. So like their pivot is like, okay, so it's a spa because they're like kind of dodging the FDA liability stuff, but their core offering is this like ultrasound, full body like ultrasound. So if you really like look into how they're doing this, it's actually not a pivot from their technology. So like, because basically they convert text to images.
Okay.
One of the hardest problems of ultrasound is you're converting sound. So basically they're just solving the same problem.
They're able to take the model and like apply it to a different use case.
Exactly. So like they convert people's, you know, blabber in text.
Did you read this number? This is the pilot in San Francisco, and then the plan is 50,000 of
Totally.
like these devices, I guess, rolled out.
I believe them. I believe them. If they can solve this like sound to image problem and just cut down a full body scan to like 30 seconds, well, people use this. And like also this is so like the only difference is that this doesn't penetrate bones and stuff, so harder tissues, bones, muscles, and etc., which is okay because like this application will have, sorry, this technology will have application at airports and etc., right? Because you don't actually want these scans to penetrate your deeper tissues. So like there's
Interesting.
military applications, there's like security applications, medical is obviously one, lots and lots of applications.
I think it's excellent. I'm
Very,
excited
very
about
cute.
it.
Very, very
And I like
cute.
the pivot. I like the fact they didn't take any money doing their own thing. It's really cool.
Yeah, and it's still solving the relatively same problem using the same product, the model.
Excellent. All right, dude, does that wrap up the show for today?
That's it for today.
Always fun.
Always fun.
Thank you,
Okay,
everybody.
bye everyone. That was good.